Listeners, good morning. That last show was Good Morning Nueva York, hosted by King Downey. That can be heard Monday through Thursday. Time right now is going to be 7 o'clock, so get ready for the next show. It's a good day with Miss Johanna Fernandez coming up.
Flying high, you know how I feel.
I was hoping it would happen before they come grab him to put him in
jail. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. New life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free.
It's 7:01. You're listening to non-corporate, listener-funded WBAI at 99.5 FM on the dial in New York and streaming everywhere at WBAI.org. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of It's a Good Day. Stay tuned for Autumn Harris with the Autumn Weather Report.
When you shine, you know how I feel. Scent of the pine, you know how I feel.
This is WBAI in New York as of 7:02 a.m. It's 26 degrees with a high of 42 and a low of 28 with feels in the low 20s. And for your trains, you can expect good service on all trains and all major bridges and tunnels, although we do urge you to check the MTA's website for planned schedule changes. Back to you, Johanna.
Grab your coffee, get ready, because we've got a dazzling, magical show today. Autumn, how are you?
I'm feeling pretty good. This cold is beating me up. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, it is a little cold out there, everyone. So bundle up, get your mitts and your scarves and your hat.
Right. Instead of saying the gloves are off, it's the mittens are off.
The mittens are on, perhaps.
Right.
So we've got some science news. On January 6th, the 235th American Astronomers Society unveiled the discovery of a new planet. It was discovered by a 17-year-old high school junior, Wolf Kuckler, at Scarsdale High School in Scarsdale, New York. He was 3 days into his internship at NASA's Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. He was looking at distant worlds, studying variations of star brightness. He started checking through data of stars that had been flagged as eclipsing binary. That means two stars that circle around each other. Then he saw a signal from a system called TOI 1338. At first, he thought it was a stellar eclipse, an eclipse of one star by another in a binary system. But the timing was wrong. It turned out to be a planet. The planet is now called TOI 1338b. It is 6.7 times the size of Earth. It is 1,300 light years from Earth. The planet is not ordinary. It orbits two suns. And one is 10 times the size of our sun, and the other is 1.2 times the size of our sun. So this is our science news, because we're trying to get ready for a conversation that we will have with a brilliant mind, one of the most brilliant minds of our time.
This is true. And wow, another planet to possibly consider moving to? I hope it's inhabitable.
Absolutely.
Well, yesterday the Supreme Court ruled not to review the constitutionality of Obamacare before the presidential election. This is a victory for Trump administration because Trump will not be forced to explain why he has no replacement for Obamacare. The court sent the case back to the Fifth Circuit with instructions. So Obamacare remains the law for at least another year. And California's attorney general had argued that any delay creates confusion for those on Obamacare that threatens their health. This Thursday, Trump lashed out at his own Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, who said that the polls indicate that the public trusts Democrats on health care more than the Republicans. Trump continues to assert falsely that he has been leading the fight to prevent people from losing health care due to pre-existing conditions. That's heavy.
That is quite heavy. And now, this is one of my favorite tunes.
Oh, let's hear it.
Head was on the block. The crime was looking up the truth. And as the bombshells of my daily fears explode, I try to trace them to my youth. And then you had to bring up reincarnation over a couple of beers the other night. And now I'm serving time for mistakes made by another in another lifetime. How long till my soul gets it right? Can any human being ever reach that kind of light? I call on the resting soul of Galileo, king of night vision, king of insight. About my fear of motion, which I never could explain. Some other fool across the ocean years ago must have crashed his little airplane. How long till my soul gets it right? Can any human being ever reach that kind of light? I call on the resting soul of Galileo, king of night vision, king of insight. I'm not making a joke. You know me, I take everything so seriously. If we wait for the time till our souls get it right, then at least I know there'll be no nuclear. Right.
morning, good morning. This is WBAI 99.5 FM on the dial, streaming globally at WBAI.org. But you knew that already. It's 7:10 a.m. and you just listened to the Indigo Girls. That song is titled Galileo. It's one of Johanna's favorites, apparently.
Yes. I learned about it in college. All the college kids were listening to the Indigo Girls when I was in college. I might be dating myself. But I am super excited for what's coming next, and I want our listening audience to get ready to ask some questions of one of the Einsteins of our time. You should call later on at around 740, 745, 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. We are honored, Autumn Harris. We are honored to have here with us Dr. Sylvester Jim Gates, Jr. Dr. Gates is an American theoretical physicist. His PhD degree is from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His doctoral thesis in 1977 was the first one at MIT to deal with supersymmetry. Are you guys listening? Y'all out there, 7-Eleven? It's cold out there in New York. Grab your coffee because we're about to bring it here at WBAI. It's a good day. In 2017, Dr. Gates retired from the University of Maryland and is currently the Brown University Theoretical Physics Center Director, Ford Foundation Professor of Physics, an Affiliate Mathematics Professor, and a Faculty Fellow of the Watson Institute for International Studies and Public Affairs at Brown University, by the way, which is my alma mater. So I'm super excited today. While at the University of Maryland, College Park, Dr. Gates was a University System Regents Professor, the John S. Toll Professor of Physics, the Director of the String and Particle Theory Center, and Affiliate Professor of Mathematics. Whoa. We've heard a lot about string theory, and folks are probably, what on earth's name is that? But we're going to be talking about that with someone who is brilliant because he is able to bring physics to the people. In 2019, together with Kathy Peltier, just recently, and this is hot off the press, he co-authored the brilliant book that I've been reading and I can't put down, Proving Einstein Right, The Daring Expeditions That Changed How We Look at the Universe. President Obama awarded Professor Gates the 2011 National Medal of Science, the highest award given to scientists in the U.S. During 1914, he was named the Harvard Foundation's Scientist of the Year. And this is something that our listening audience will be very happy about because we need Dr. Gates on our side. In 2019, he was invited to serve on the American Bar Association Steering Committee for the annual prescription for criminal justice and forensic science, because we're going to be talking about abolition at some point in the future. And maybe Dr. Gates can tell us something about abolition in prisons. Dr. Gates.
Please call me Jim.
Dr. Jim. Okay, I'll have to call you Dr. Jim. Dr. Jim, thank you so much for joining us. He came from outer space and landed here at WBAI. He was in Florida, and he flew into New York specifically to speak to It's a Good Day. So we are honored, and we are excited. Welcome to our show.
Well, again, Johanna, thank you for that introduction, but I must tell you, you put me to sleep reading all those words about things that I've been recognized with. For me, it's all about the work, and the work is trying to make sure that I am able to do what seems to be a sort of a calling. I was 4 years old when I first started thinking about doing science.
I read about this. Apparently, you went to see a sci-fi film, and at 4 years old, you came back home, and you were trying to explain to your father how to build a rocket.
That's correct. And so I've always been headed this way. It feels very natural. It's part of who I am. I can't separate myself from the science I try to do.
Well, let me just tell our listening audience that Dr. Gates is also black. So I'm especially proud of that.
Wow, really? I thank you for that discovery.
I'm leaving.
Okay, so you know, let's start out with a joke. Let's just keep it real, because we're trying to keep it real here at WBAI. Can you tell us the joke about the dinosaur?
Well, sure. So many times people ask me, why do I do science? And so I say, look out the window. Do you see any dinosaurs? And they look at me with a quizzical look and say, no, there are no dinosaurs. I said, you know, that's probably because there were no dinosaur scientists. Now, what does that actually mean? Well, we all know that the dinosaurs died millions of years ago, and it apparently was due to a meteor strike on the Earth. This meteor strike changed the environmental conditions. It's like the opposite of global warming, where basically no sunlight was coming down to the surface. Plant life died. The herbivores, the dinosaurs who ate the plants, couldn't live. And then the carnivores who ate the herbivores all died out. And so that's how we lost the dinosaurs. So environments change on this planet, and they change fairly regularly. We may, as a species, see that in the next 100 years with climate change. If that happens, how do we defend ourselves? Well, we're going to need technology. How do you get that technology? It rests on science. So science is really a way that we protect ourselves and bet on our long-term future.
Well, listen, sign me up. Can we hire you right now? Because we got problems coming to us with a quickness. So we need science to solve problems, but also to prevent catastrophe. And later on, perhaps you can enlighten us on the environmental catastrophe that awaits us. More specifically, you're a theoretical physicist beyond being a scientist, as was Einstein. Can you tell us, what is it exactly that physicists do?
Well, physicists, first of all, are very arrogant mostly. And so if you ask us what we do, we say, explain everything. We try to explain everything. But really what we do is try to use mathematics to get a very clear picture of how nature works, because we want us to understand her rules. Because by understanding her rules well, you ultimately get apps like navigation apps. You don't get that without first understanding her rules. You get to build massive communication systems with satellites that allow us to instantly communicate with friends around the world. All of that stuff comes from science. And so that's what we as theorists are trying to do, find the math. And one of the greatest predictions, by the way, happened in the 1860s. You're all beneficiaries of it, but you've never heard of it. You call it radio. That actually started as a piece of math in the 1860s. That's what we do as theoretical physicists.
Wait, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yes.
Can you tell us radio waves?
Yes.
Has something to do with waves, I imagine.
Yes.
So can you tell us the science of the radio? That was not one of my questions, but we at WBAI want to know the answer to this, because this is, we're trying to be a people's radio station.
Sure.
So put the people in the radio too. It's 718. This is WBAI 99.5 FM on the dial. I'm Johanna Fernandez, talking to the brilliant physicist, theoretical physicist, Dr. Jim Gates, on the nature of the universe.
So in the 1860s, there was a physicist, a theoretical physicist by the name of James Clerk Maxwell. And he wrote some equations, four of them. They're relatively simple. In fact, they will fit on the upper half of a paragraph of a book that you might hold, upper page. They don't even fill the half of an upper page. These four books are mathematical equations that describe everything that had ever been discovered about electricity and magnetism up to his time. These equations also make a prediction. They say if you take a battery and a magnet and put them together with some wires and do something to it, you generate a piece of electricity that travels outside of the wires. Now, this is a crazy idea that you get electricity just flowing without wires.
You mentioned this in the book, I think.
We did in our book, among other things that physicists do.
Okay, go
ahead.
And
so in 1888, another physicist said, well, if this was a mathematical prediction, no one had ever seen it. So you got to actually go out and ask, did they get it right? Heinrich Hertz was a German physicist. He measured these pieces of electricity flying through the air with no wires. The next important figure in our story is a guy named Marconi, because he said if these pieces of electricity are flying through the air, we can use them to send messages. That's the beginning of radio waves.
And I imagine of the computer system that is now wireless, That's everywhere Wi-Fi, around this.
For the Wi-Fi itself, again, it came from these four equations that most people have never heard of.
Yowza. It's 7:20. Grab your coffee. Hang on to your seats because we're trying to understand the universe and how science and physics and math have changed the way we live. WBAI 99.5 FM on the dial. We're talking to Dr. Jim Gates, who's the author of a brilliant new book, Proving Einstein Right, The Daring Expeditions That Changed How We Look at the Universe. Okay, so physicists try to understand the physical world, but also the universe, and understand its patterns, its structure, its logic. One of the most well-known physicists in history is Einstein. And your book is organized around folks who tried to help Einstein do his thing. So, and everybody has heard of Einstein. Can you tell us what is Einstein's most important contribution to our understanding of the universe?
Well, for me, it's not what people think of mostly. A lot of people like to say atomic energy, the most famous equation in the world, E equals MC squared. All that's Einstein's work. But to me, the most amazing thing that Einstein did is he gave science a way to understand how the entire universe came into existence. It tells us that in about 13.7 billion years ago, there was a very strange event that we call the Big Bang, and that the universe got its start in this event. And it went through transformations of space and time and matter and energy for those 13.8 or 13.7 billion years. And in that entire time, the universe creates exactly one copy of you. To me, this is the greatest thing that I know about Einstein's work, to know how I am connected to this big place and that every one of us has this kind of sense of involvement, engagement, investment by the universe to make sure that we get here.
I'm a star.
You are a part of a star.
Oh.
No, by that I mean there are parts of your bodies that came from stars.
Right.
Yeah.
So can you explain that? Because that's something that we hear all the time, that we are stardust.
Yes. So it's literally true. And the person that popularized it was Carl Sagan. It turns out that we all go to high school mostly. And we walk in these science classes and we see this thing called the table of elements that starts with hydrogen and then helium, lithium, boron, blah, 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 right? Goes on. But it turns out that of those elements, if you go down the table, you're getting to heavier and heavier elements until you get to iron. And all of those were actually cooked by the universe. You can think of the universe as a big oven making these new elements over and over again until you get to iron. And then, in fact, the cooking process actually stops. Except in one place, in the explosions of stars, things called supernovas, they cook up all the elements heavier than iron. And it's some of those heavier elements are what you need to make blood work.
Whoa.
So literally, we are constructed from things that come from stars.
And blood is pretty heavy, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly necessary, if not heavy.
Whoa. Okay, so you are listening to Dr. Jim Gates, who's the author of Proving Einstein Right, The Daring Expeditions That Changed How We Look at the Universe. He's also a professor of physics and director of many centers and generally big man on campus at Brown University. We're very excited to have him here, and we're talking about the nature of the universe. I started reading this book, and I'm dumbfounded because I'm an historian, and part of what this book does is that it joins the liberal arts, the humanities, literature, history with science. In many ways, it humanizes the scientists. It's very accessible, and it's organized around the astronomers who helped Einstein figure out whether, in fact, it's true that light passing through the sun deviates a little bit. So the entire book is organized around these astronomers who are chasing solar eclipses. It's so deep on so many different levels. It reads like a novel. And it really made me feel connected to the universe, connected to myself. It gave me a sense of Einstein and who he is and as a human being, but also the significance of wonder and dreaming to the process of creation and science. So at some point, you tell us that one of the most important inventions or discoveries by Einstein happened when he was catching a ride on a bus. So part of what I've left with is that the process of being a scientist is not so necessarily up in the head, but it's almost embodied. It's on the ground. You kind of have to go with what you're feeling in the physical world and really surrender to the process of inquiry and problem solving, which we're engaged in all the time as human beings. Every day we wake up, we've got to solve a problem. And so science should not be as, you know, scary as we imagine it is. It's actually here with us in our bodies in the daily life we lead. But unfortunately, science is thought of as this elite, inaccessible thing. Sir, I want to assign this book to my students. Tell me more about this book and why you wrote it.
Well, first of all, thank you, Joanna, for that reaction to the book. The book is a strange creation, and we need to have people tell us whether we succeeded in doing something that we've never seen done before. As you mentioned, it is a joining. It's an attempt at a joining. And let me make sure that your audience understands that my co-author is a novelist. She has written novels for 30 years. Some of her novels have been made into movies. Mm. And so we were looking for a quality of storytelling that anyone not necessarily interested in science could pick up and just read a great story. And what we mostly wanted to do was to let our audience into the interior life of the scientists upon which we focus, the eight astronomers that we chose as the heroes of our story. They went around the world trying to make this measurement. So what were they actually trying to do? So let me describe that for a second. Imagine I had a glass of water and I passed it back and forth in front of your faces. As I looked at you through this glass, it would look like your face is moving, even though you're not moving. What's actually moving is the distortion of the light caused by my glass full of water. That's the kind of thing that these scientists were trying to measure. But instead of using a glass of water, using the sun. Now, they wanted to measure starlight.
The distortion of light.
The distortion of the path of starlight.
Oh, the distortion of the path of
starlight.
Right,
because as I'm moving this glass, you're not moving. It's the path of the light that's moving. And that's why it seems to move to me. So they're trying to do this with the sun. But wait, starlight, you can't see starlight with the sun out. And so the only time you can make this measurement is through an eclipse, when the moon covers the face of the sun and lets you see the starlight that passes around the sun. And the most amazing thing about it was what they were trying to do. Now, remember, this is like in the 1900s. We follow them from 1911 to 1922. They have success in 1918. What are they trying to do? Well, imagine I had a dime. If I had a dime and I was holding it up and said, which side am I looking at? You might look at my eyes and say, oh, it's the left or right side. Now imagine me doing that 1.3 miles away from you. It would be pretty hard for you to tell which side I'm looking at, unless you had a very powerful telescope. That's what they were trying to measure in terms of the motion of the apparent motion of the stars. Think of it, 1.3 miles, the thickness of a dime. How do you measure it? That's the challenge they had technically. They were going to, they went to Africa, they went to Brazil, they went to Australia. There were people up in near Arctic. This was over a decade's worth of work. And why were they trying to do this? Because Einstein had predicted how much the stars would bend. Would it be one dime's worth or two? Before him, Newton had said one. He said from his 1915 work, it would be the thickness of 2 dimes. And that's what they're all measuring.
Okay. Wow. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM on the dial. It's 7:30. Grab your coffee. We're continuing a conversation with Dr. Jim Gates, who's the author of the phenomenal new book, very accessible for all audiences, Proving Einstein Right, The Daring Expeditions That Changed How We Look at the Universe. And we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Gates in person here at WBAI, which is at 388 Atlantic Avenue at 10 a.m. So why don't you skip work and skip school and come join us? 10 a.m. I think it's worth it. This is an education of a lifetime, access to someone that we often don't have access to, who's explaining science to us in a very accessible manner, but also talking to us about its significance to how we live. It's 7:31. Once again, grab your coffee. So what's amazing about your book is that it really involves not just the theoretical physicist, the brilliant Einstein, but it involves astronomers, technicians, technology. One gets a sense that you brainiacs can't do it alone. You have to work with other folks to bring your dreams to fruition, in fact, to prove your dreams. And that's what's really beautiful. It's this collaborative effort among people who don't often know each other, but they're excited by essentially stretching our understanding of the known. Can you speak on that? But before I say that, what was inspiring to me is that people really didn't know who Einstein was when he was trying to figure out how light deflects from the sun, from the stars, and at what angle. They didn't really know who he was. And this is what you say in your book, page 33, about the relationship of regular people to geniuses. Quote, he's quoting the English satirist Jonathan Swift. This is what the Swift says, quote, "When a true genius appears in the world, you may know him by this sign that the dunces are all in confederacy against him," unquote. So when there's someone who knows what they're talking about and who has a crazy idea, everyone is trying to bring them down. Those are the haters in the house. But part of what you then continue to say is, well, it wasn't exactly the case with Einstein, because no one really knew who he was, and he was writing in German. Yet there's an army of astronomers who were like, yeah, let's see if this guy is right, and we're going to contribute to that process, and we're going to go around the world to chase an eclipse to figure out if we can help him in his little experiment.
So first of all, I would modify your statements. Scientists don't do things to help each other. What they do is try to prove each other wrong.
Now, whoa, okay.
Because one of the things that is an enormous misconception about this, about in the public mind about science, is that we're trying to actually prove and help each other. That's not what we're trying to do. We make it up. And then because we understand that it's made up, we have to go to an authority and say, did we get it right or wrong? Now, we can't go to each other because each one of us has the capacity to make up things. The authority is nature herself. And so what these astronomers were doing was trying to go to nature and said, do you agree with what Einstein has predicted with his math? That's a very subtly different process.
Okay, so for our listening audience, it's 7:34. You're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM, streaming globally at WBAI.org. I'm Johanna Fernandez, the host of It's a Good Day, and I have the honor of speaking to Dr. Jim Gates, who's talking to us about science, what theoretical physicists do. And essentially, you're telling us that theoretical physicists have an idea of how the world works. And other scientists and technicians and technology and astronomers, they go out to test the theory in nature, not to prove the theorist right, but possibly wrong. Whoa. Now, we've got a lot to cover. We want to tell our listening audience that we're going to open up the lines in 10 minutes, and you should call 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. Before we speak about your own phenomenal and brilliant work, can you explain for our listening audience what on earth's name is space-time?
What is space-time?
And who came up with this concept? Of course, we know, but
okay,
please.
So again, you know, these days, certainly in our public debate, we hear a lot about fake news. But most of what we know outside of politics is also fake news. So if you ask most people who have looked a little bit at this question, they'll say, oh, Albert Einstein made up the idea of space-time. It turns out not to be true. The person who actually came up with the concept was a man named Hermann Minkowski, who had been one of Einstein's teachers.
A mathematician.
Absolutely. So he's the person who first came up with this really weird idea that, you know, we can move front and back, we can move up and down, we can move left and right. That's kind of defined space because it's something that we can move through. We actually move through time also because I have a memory of what was going on yesterday. So I move forward in time, but I don't know how to move backward in time. And so what Hermann Minkowski did was looked at the mathematics that Einstein invented in 1905. He looked at it as a mathematician and said, wait a minute, what Einstein sort of thinks of as the separate thing, time and space, although they can warp into each other, Hermann Minkowski said they're actually the same thing. That though we can't move back and forth in time, it is in fact part of space. So it's a weird idea. And it gets us things like nuclear energy in the end.
So space-time, so in space-time, time exists on a continuum and you can move forward and backward. We move forward, but it also exists in reverse.
Yes. And in fact, there are things apparently in nature that do go backwards in time.
Like what?
Electrons.
Hmm.
This is an idea that a physicist by the name of Richard Feynman used to win a Nobel Prize in the 60s. So there are things that apparently do go back in time, but we're just not among those blessed few.
So what's the significance that electrons go back in time? Why is that important? Why is that like, whoa?
Because it's the origin of antimatter. Everybody's heard about matter and antimatter. Antimatter appears to be matter moving backwards in time, according to Richard Feynman.
All right. So it's 7:37. You're listening to WBAI streaming globally at 99 at WBAI.org, on the dial at 99.5 FM. Dr. Gates, you are the theorist responsible for something called supersymmetry. Mm-hmm. And it was the subject of your thesis, your doctoral thesis at MIT, when no one knew what that was about or what. So tell us, what is supersymmetry?
Okay, so first of all, I'm not the originator of supersymmetry. It actually has a separate, two really bizarre, simultaneously unconnected origin stories. One is behind the Iron Curtain in the Ukraine in the late 60s. The other is in the early 70s, starting in Geneva, Switzerland, where the LHC currently operates. But what I am is the first person at MIT who was looking at the math that was coming from these sources. And I realized as a graduate student in around 1975, 1976, that this mathematics predicted even more forms of matter over antimatter. These things that we call supermatter are superpartners. And for me, I was stunned because I realized I was living at a time where this new idea had been injected into physics. And it, if it was correct and accurate, it would make predictions like Maxwell's that led to Wi-Fi. So I was the only person in 1975 or 1976 who had this realization at MIT, and I wrote my PhD thesis on the subject.
Okay, but I mean, so what do you posit? What does supersymmetry posit?
Okay, the basic idea of supersymmetry, as in all symmetries, is a kind of a balance. Because symmetry is about balance. And in fact, the mathematics that we use for symmetry is almost all about balance and various sundry ways that we can conceive of in our mathematical explanations of the universe. So the balance that I can most simply tell you about is a balance between things like electrons and things like light. Particles of light are called photons. If you look at the equations that people like Maxwell, who was the inventor, the mathematical inventor of Wi-Fi, if you look at those equations, they are not at all balanced between light on the one hand and electrons on the other, even though ultimately electrons cause light. But they're not balanced. The theory of supersymmetry is a mathematical extension that, by imagining that there are more particles that we haven't seen, replaces that balance. And so that's the essence of supersymmetry. It is also required for string theory, by the way.
Okay, so part of what I'm hearing and what I've read and discovered in researching for this segment is that the universe wants balance and symmetry. And even though the theorists can't see it, it's there. That balance between one side of an equation and the other. Just because we can't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. We just haven't found the technology to help us find and identify those other particles that exist. And part of what you're saying, which is huge, is that, okay, there's this equation that kind of looks odd. And in fact, it looks odd when you look at it. And you're saying the universe, nature, everything is symmetrical. What are the corresponding elements to the other side of the graph that are not there? And you're trying to find those particles, whatever they are. And that's essentially the theory of supersymmetry, which gave string theory a new lease on life. And for those of you who do not know, string theory posits that the smallest structure in the universe, in reality, are very tiny pieces of string that vibrate. So part of what scientists try to do is understand reality and the universe and the physical world by identifying its component parts and its smallest element. Because if you have its smallest element, then you understand everything. And so can you explain to us how it was that your theoretical work gave string theory a new lease on life?
Well, it wasn't, as I said, I demur from your praise. What I have done is make contributions that are singular and that are not like other kind of the contributions that come from other people. So,
right. So I'm trying to toot that horn.
It's not that it's painful, but it's just that as a scientist, I have to make sure that we're being accurate because we're all about accuracy. So I have made contributions that are singular. And among those,
what does singular mean to our listening audience?
It means no one else did it.
Okay. God, I'm just saying.
It means no one else did it. So I've made contributions that, for example, a class of my contributions are about the way that Einstein's idea of space-time is incorporated in supersymmetry. This is something that I did when I was a postdoc working together with another physicist by the name of Warren Siegel at Harvard in 1977-1978 period. That's been one of my contributions. I have also made contributions that get rid of this notion that the string theory requires that there are extra hidden dimensions. It turns out there are versions of strings that don't have these things. And what I've done in that piece of mathematics is tied back to the model of electrons and particles of light that we have known for hundreds of years. So I can go down a list of things. I've also created a set of weird graphical pictures called adinkras, which capture the essence of supersymmetry in a way that no other piece of mathematics have. And I'm still exploring that to this day.
So this is very important. We have a caller on the line that we're going to get to in a minute. But you are also working on adinkras. Essentially, we haven't had time to talk about math and what it is. We learn math abstractly and theoretically in is cool, but we don't really understand its application or where it comes from. Part of what you've done is that you've created a system wherein we can see math visually. Math equations are now things that we can see visually through your work, and that's what you call adinkras. But let's go straight to our listening audience. We've got lots of callers. Caller, WBAI 99.5 FM on the dial. I'm Johanna Fernandez speaking to Dr. Jim Gates. What's your name and where you're calling from?
Hi. I just want to say I really appreciate your guests and your work that you've brought here to WBAI. I'm Zabby. I called yesterday. I just wanted to make a note. I do have a question for Dr. Gates, and but I just want to say that yesterday I called at the end, and I did want to say that Shalene Rodriguez would make a wonderful candidate. I was inspired by that show yesterday and what she had to say with local organizing.
Zabby, let's go to our question to Dr. Gates, please, because we've got all kinds of callers, and we've got like 10 callers.
I have the question. Could he please help us fight 5G, talking about radio waves and waves that 5G, and we're talking about technology and so forth. Can he possibly help us fight the 5G coming to us that might affect our health, as we have heard? And where is he on this subject? And
thank you very much, Zabby.
Zabby, I'm sorry, I cannot help you on that, because, in fact, the fears that people have around 5G are an extension of fears that we've heard that go back to even to the time of Ben Franklin. There were people fearful of lightning rods. And so the kind of news that you've heard, which people think is accurate, as a scientist, I see no evidence for believing that. So I'm sorry.
Caller, we're moving on to our next caller. Caller, you're on the line. Where are you calling from? What's your name?
My name is James. I'm calling from Queens.
Hi, James.
And I'd like to congratulate Mr. Jim what he's doing, because you don't hear many black scientists talking these days. Neil deGrasse is just lucky, but to have you is the most important part. Now, I'd like to know that, does he know that Einstein taught at Lincoln University, which is a black college?
Well, first of all, thank you. Einstein did not actually teach at Lincoln. He gave a commencement address at Lincoln at a time of his life when he had stopped giving commencement addresses. There are very famous pictures of him there talking to black students, meeting the president of Lincoln University, who, by the way, was the father of Julian Bond. So there's actually a picture of Julian Bond's father with
Einstein.
The civil rights activist. So I'm very much aware of that. Many of us know all of that story.
Caller, you're on the line. Caller, you're on your line. Yes. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hello?
Yes, your name and where you're calling from.
James, I just called. I'd like to know.
Sorry, James. Moving on to our next caller. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name. Keep it short and where you're calling from, because we've got like 12 people on hold.
Sure, this is Thad.
Tag? Thad. Thad. Hi, Thad. Speak louder, please. Tell us.
Sure. Hey, quick question, Dr. Gates, and thank you for this show, Johanna. I'm a lover of science. This is awesome. In all of your studies, Dr. Gates, does your knowledge of the universe prove the existence of God to you?
No, I'm afraid. There is a barrier in science. Science operates without reference to faith at all. Science does not look to disprove faith, but it also doesn't work to prove faith. So it's just totally mute.
Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from. Keep it short.
My name is Carol. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Carol, thank you for calling.
I appreciate so much your show, Johanna. And it's New Day, and I appreciate Dr. Jim. And
can you put your radio down, please?
Yeah, I just did.
This is a physics question. Why does that happen?
It's a question from a teacher of young children, and asking Dr. Jim for his advice on what kind of activities that will inspire children, where to what to expose them to. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the question. I was the beneficiary of an extraordinary set of teachers, starting with my parents. When I was very young and just starting school, my dad placed into my consciousness that questions have answers. And he did it in a practical way by answering questions hither and yon about all kinds of subjects. One of the strangest questions I remember asking Dad is, why do locomotives have doors in their roofs for the engine where the fireman and the engineer operate? And he had an answer for me. So one of the first things as a parent that one can do is act in the role of teacher. I have to tell you that I have a set of twins, 26 years old, and both of them look like they're going to be physicists because I tried to do for my kids what my dad did. So it starts long before school. Let young people be free in their ability to ask questions. Don't hinder them. Don't mock them. Let them become the awesome people they are.
Physics for the people, science for the people's caller. What's your name and where you're calling from?
Yes, Jim from Brooklyn. I have two questions for Dr. Gates with regard to the speed of light.
Go for it.
Okay, number one is a question that probably everybody in your field gets asked. Is if the speed of light is a given, like, say, 186,000 miles per second or 3 times 10 to the 8th meters per second, if two people shine flashlights at each other, what happens there?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the part.
If two people what?
Shine flashlights at each other.
Shine flashlights at each other. We're just going to take it one question, sir, because we've got so many people on hold.
Okay, first of all, that question has been answered by Albert Einstein in 1905, and the answer is that they measure the speed of light of each flashlight as being 186,000 miles per second.
So it doesn't change?
So it does not change.
Caller, you're on the line. What's your name and where are you calling from?
First of all, good morning, New York.
Yay.
My name is Kwaku. I'm calling from the great state of New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm happy to say that I'm a WBAI buddy. Okay? Got it?
Well, make sure you're a WBAI buddy on It's a Good Day. But go ahead.
I am. Absolutely.
What's your name, sir? I need your name.
K-W-A-K-U. Kwaku. Born on a Wednesday from the Ashanti in Ghana.
Okie doke.
Gentlemen talk about the Ndikra. Indigra symbols come out of Ghana, sir. I'm certain he knows that.
They actually don't just come out of Ghana. They come from the Akan people, which are spread not just in Ghana but beyond. We're very well familiar with the traditional Dinkras. And our use of the word is that we honor this tradition, but our Dinkras have nothing to do with traditional ones.
Go ahead, oh, Mr.
Good.
Kwaku.
Okay. Hello to all of the guests. Now, I read a book called Disciplined Minds by Eric Smith. He, too, is a physicist, and he was the editor of Physics Today before he was terminated. It's an older book. But what this book examines is that in the field of physics, as I'm certain you know, the dominant paradigm is to support capitalism and to support the military-industrial complex. This is why he talked about the idea of disciplined minds, that many people come out, even Oppenheimer, as you know, didn't raise the implications of the atomic bomb until it was dropped. So my question to you is, how is it that you've been able to escape the disciplined minds and give us a physics, from what I understand, that deals with humanity, that everything you say can be understood, and how do we get out of the paradigm of physics being in a capture of the military-industrial complex, as you may agree it is in its dominant sense? So I'm going to hang up and listen off air, okay?
Sure. So first of all, physics, as you described, is being captured along with all the rest of science. You might as well describe our society as the same way. Science turns out to be a luxury. Namely, if all the scientists in the world stopped doing their work tomorrow, it would not affect the way most people live. In about 20 years, however, 20, 30 years, some problems would arise and you'd have no solutions for them. So science is a tool for creating solutions. Now, it's true that in the context of the historical development of science and the societal development around science, the parts of our society who recognize that most are entrepreneurs and the military because it makes their job easier. But we don't have a society that supports the science in general because people have lives to live. And those lives don't place a high priority on having solutions for problems 30, 40, 50, and 60 years into the future.
Thank you so very much for that question about capitalism and science. Caller, you're on the line. Caller, you're on the line. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Yes, good morning. This is Figel from Jersey City. I just have a very simple question. Is there a relationship between philosophy and the work that you do, Dr. Gates?
That's a very interesting question because I'm a physicist. Physics is the only part of science that evolved from the liberal arts. In fact, physics, up until the time of Isaac Newton, was known as natural philosophy. So literally, yes, we are related to philosophers.
Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, this is George. I'm calling from New Jersey. How are you?
George, good. Thank you for calling.
All right, just quickly, Tesla said about much of Einstein's theories that it was a peasant dressed in purple, you know, looking to be a prince, you know. And Einstein bowed to Tesla saying, you know, you're the smartest man in the world. You know, he said, you better ask Tesla. What are we to deduce from that, you know, little tip there and the fact that Tesla was quite a genius and, you know, he did say that, you know, a lot of guesswork, a lot of mathematical work was done with Einstein. That just doesn't, you know what I mean, just formulas to boggle the mind. And you say that science doesn't prove about God or disprove God. But when you talk in your jargon, in the scientific jargon, aren't you asking us to take a leap of faith and believe?
Take a leap of faith and believe in something. Thank you so very much, George, because I wanted to ask a question about Tesla and his significance, too. Go ahead, sir. Dr. Jim.
Okay, so, you know, it's interesting that I should get a question about Tesla. I actually just watched a documentary about the history of electricity and magnetism. And in fact, in the last episode of the documentary, they treat Tesla. There is in our society, in my opinion, and from all the evidence I've read, there is a misjudgment about the significance of Tesla. Yes, he did something incredible. And yes, our society might have been benefited in a way that would advantage the general population if decisions had been made in his favor, but they were not. As for Tesla's talking about Einstein's contributions, that was his personal opinion. Each of us who is a scientist is an individual. We have a right to personal opinions. However, our opinions may not be shared by the majority of people who do what we do, and Tesla is unfortunately one of those people whose opinions is not shared broadly in the scientific community.
Oh, it's not?
No, it's not.
Okay, it's 7:57. Before we take our last caller, I just want to credit Ajamu Sankofa, with whom I discussed this book and this show. And also, I want to credit Jürgen Ostensen and, of course, our Autumn Harris for the work to put this show together, which was not easy. 7:57 WBAI, you're on the line. You're our last caller. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Yes, good morning. My name is Rob, and I just wanted to say to Dr. Gates, we briefly met years ago at an Asimov debate that I brought my sons to, and I just want to tell you I was so proud to have my sons see two black physicists sitting up there dropping that knowledge. That was good. That was good. But here's my question. One of those guys now is looking at calculus, and he's really, you know, humming the blues. Can you give us a little bit of advice as to how we can get these, particularly the males, to approach, you know, the higher mathematics
sure.
with some degree of success?
So, you know, one of the things that's unfortunate is about how poorly mathematics generally is taught in the public school systems. And this is almost universal. It cuts across even racial barriers. The quality of math teaching in general in this country is simply not at the level where it becomes accessible to the vast majority of students. So what I tell people is if you're in a formal educational system, you know, with a high school teacher, what have you, what you need to try to do is explore some informal things.
20 seconds.
Go online is my short solution. There are great content in all kinds of mathematics online. Parents and students can find it.
Join us at 10 a.m. here at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Today, we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Gates. It's been a pleasure. Have a great day. This is Johanna Fernandez.
Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life.